Our speaker tonight is Venerable Thupten Chodron. She was born in 1950, the same year I was born. Discovering that fact started me thinking about the choices I have made and the choices she has made in her life. I chose to lead a secular life and have children, be involved in the conventional day-to-day. And Thupten Chodron, in choosing to be a monastic, has chosen a much more stringent and inwardly demanding life. With the perspective of years, I look back and marvel at what different roads we have traveled as a result of these choices. I have walked what a well-known philosopher, Paul Breton, has called the long path. This is the go through it over and over until you finally get it school of spiritual practice. As Venerable Tenzin Palmo said last week, unless you catch that afflictive emotion, be it anger, resentment, hatred, whatever, before it manifests, well, then it's too late. You'll be riding that horse until it runs itself ragged. But the monastics, the nuns and monks, and some incredibly devoted lay people commit themselves to watching their minds until they can catch the arisal of an afflictive emotion before it manifests as thought or action. This is the short path. And wow, is what I've got to say to that. And what a gift they are able to give us, to communicate what they have learned during their practice, to give us the benefit of all their hard work. Venerable Thupten Chodron graduated with a BA in history from the University of California at Los Angeles in 1971. After traveling through Europe, North Africa, and Asia, she received a teaching credential and went to the University of Southern California to do work in education while working as a teacher in the Los Angeles school system. It's here that she understood what our children need, and I quote, "I still think that children need to be taught to be good human beings more than they need math and science." Venerable Thupten Chodron has studied and practiced Buddhism for many years in India and Nepal. She was ordained in 1977 and received the Chuni, which is full ordination, in Taiwan in 1986. She travels around the world teaching Buddhism and meditation and has been active in the establishment of centers in Italy, France, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Seattle. The life of the monastic, especially the Western nuns and monks, is not an easy path. There are a few monasteries or nunneries to give them a sangha for support and community. Many of them travel around the world to support and teach Buddhism around at Buddhist centers. This has been the story of Venerable Thupten Chodron's life. However, she is working to change that by starting Srivasti Abbey at Liberation Park in Missouri. Srivasti Abbey is an innovative yet traditional Buddhist monastery where monks and nuns can live, train, and work together, supporting each other's spiritual life. Venerable Chodron has been remarkably active in helping to bring Buddhism to the West. She was a co-organizer of the conference Life as a Western Buddhist Nun and took part in the conferences of Western Buddhist teachers with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in 1993 and 1994. She has also attended several of the Mind and Life conferences in which scientists and His Holiness discuss similarities and differences between science and Buddhism, of which you have heard mentioned. She is the author of several well-known books, including Taming the Monkey Mind, Blossoms of the Dharma, Living as a Buddhist Nun, What Color is Your Mind?, Buddhism for Beginners, Open Heart, Clear Mind, and Working with Anger. Her special gift is to explain Buddhism in popular, everyday terms, so it makes sense to us in a way that we can use it in our daily lives. As His Holiness says in the foreword to the Taming of the Monkey Mind, Thupten Chodron's approach shows people how to find peace and contentment through a practical application of the teachings of the Compassionate Buddha. Tonight, Thupten Chodron will be speaking to us about working with anger. And I can tell you I'm looking forward to her talk, because anger is one of those emotional states that we are all familiar with. And we are getting very mixed advice these days on how to deal with our anger. Some say we need to own our anger. Some say we need to express it. Some say we need to overcome it. And yet others say we need to transform it. Nearly all of us have come up against this dilemma, and I'm sure you are anxious to hear Thupten Children's perspective. Please welcome Venerable Thupten Children. Small person in a big chair.
Okay. Good. It's nice to be here with all of you. I always like to start things with a little bit of silent meditation because most of us have been running around all day. It's nice to have a little break and a time to make a transition. So if you just put your hands near that, lower your eyes. Feel yourself sitting here in this chair. And be aware of your breath. So simply be aware of what it feels like as you breathe in and breathe out. Enjoy breathing. And let yourself be content to breathe. So let's take a minute just to do that, let the mind settle down. Before we begin, let's take a moment just to generate our motivation. And so let's think that this evening we will share and listen together so that we can identify and then let go of our faults so we can recognize some good qualities. And we want to do this not simply for our own well-being, because we live in a world where we're totally interdependent with everybody else. And so we want to undergo this process of working on ourselves, of developing ourselves so that we'll be able to make a positive contribution to society, so that we'll be able to work for the long-term benefit of all living beings, all the way up to full enlightenment. So take a minute and just generate that altruistic intention. Let your heart open in compassion to others and make that your motivation for what we're doing together this evening. Then open your eyes and come out of your meditation. I always waited for them to put a piece of chocolate down the tip of the microphone. Put it right up next to you. Okay, so we're going to talk about anger this evening. Let me define anger first so that we're all on the same page about that. Because I'm using the word in a very, general way rather than a very particular way. Okay, so anger is not referring to behavior. Okay, and I know from the Mind and Life conferences that very often, scientists, when they talk about emotions, say that there's three components. One is the physiological, one is the feeling content, and then the third is the behavior. Well, in Buddhism, when we're talking about emotions, we're talking specifically about the feeling content. We're not talking about, the body. I mean, what the body is doing may correlate with the emotion, but it's not the emotion. Okay? Similarly, the behavior itself is not the emotion. The behavior is the action. It's an action. Okay? So when we're talking about anger, I'm using it in a very broad, general way, referring to any mental state in which we exaggerate or project negative qualities on someone or something to the extent that we can no longer endure that person or situation and object, and we have the desire to either strike at it or get away from it. Okay? So look at the definition of anger there. It's a mind that exaggerates or projects negativity. Now, when you're angry, do you feel like you're exaggerating and projecting? No! Are you kidding? When I'm mad, I'm right. There's no exaggeration here. I'm right, you're wrong. The solution is you change. That's it. Very simple. Okay? So it's hard for us when we think about anger to really realize that there's this element of exaggeration or projection going on in there. Okay, I'll come back to that in a minute. When I'm emphasizing that anger is not the behavior, it's because many people think that because they don't yell and scream, they don't have a problem with anger. I thought that for many years. I'm not a yeller and screamer. So I thought, I don't have a problem with anger. It's this family member or that family member that does. I don't have too much of a problem. Well, how many of you, when you get angry, clam up? Who are the clammer uppers? Who are the exploder outers? Yeah? How many people do both for variety? Okay. So just because we don't yell and scream doesn't mean we don't have a problem with anger. So that's why I'm emphasizing that anger isn't the behavior. Because we can be extremely passive when we're angry, can't we? We get so passive that we just shut down, turn away, close the door, goodbye, go to sleep. Not going to talk to you. Well, you know, that's the behavior. The other behavior is you yell and scream and throw things. So we can get confused because there's two different behaviors that are, you know, quite opposite, that both can be done motivated by the same emotion. Similarly, when we talk about patience as the antidote to anger, we're not talking about the behavior. You know, first of all, patience doesn't mean the ability to wait for somebody else. Okay, I'm not using it in that way. I'm using patience as the mind that is calm in the confront of suffering or danger or, you know, criticism, abuse, something like that. Okay. Now, if we don't understand that patience is the mental attitude and instead we think that patience is the behavior, then there's a good likelihood we're going to misunderstand what patience is and think that patience is just, you know, you roll over on your back and show your belly and surrender and become the world's doormat. You know, that's not patience. Yeah. Patience is that inner feeling of calm. Yeah. And from that inner feeling of calm, we can assess a situation. And some situations, we may decide that our behavior needs to be very upfront and very assertive and very out there. Other times, we may decide our behavior requires being more peaceful. Okay? So what I'm getting at is you can have really aggressive behavior that's motivated by anger or motivated by patience, and you can have very passive behavior that's either motivated by anger or motivated by patience. Okay? So what we're talking about here is our internal mind, not the behavior. Right? That's really important to understand. Okay, now let's come back to when I was talking about anger. You know, I'm using it as a broad, general category that includes minor forms of anger, such as getting annoyed or irritated, up to, you know, getting frustrated, and then increasing more till we're outraged or enraged or belligerent, rebellious, spiteful. Okay? You getting the idea? Yeah. So there's a lot of various emotions that fall under this category of anger. I'm kind of including all of them here, okay? Because they all share this quality of exaggerating and projecting negativity on someone or something. And like I said, when we're angry, we don't think of ourselves as exaggerating and projecting. We think of ourselves as seeing things very clearly and being right. Mm-hmm. Now, I know for me, this was one of the key things for me in learning to, you know, my process of learning to deal with my anger is seeing how I am exaggerating, because at the time I'm so locked into feeling right that I can't see it. Now, why are we exaggerating when we're angry? Okay. Now, when we're angry, we're usually looking at the situation through a filter. Yeah. A very small, like a little periscope, you know, a very small filter. The filter is called me. You know that one? Okay? It has other synonyms. Me, I, my, mine. You know? All centers are on this one here. So when we're angry, we are looking at the situation through that filter of me. And we're interpreting everything that's going on through that filter of me, because after all, I am the center of the universe. You know, I mean, the world hasn't quite understood that yet, you know, which is why people are so often wrong. But if they would wise up and recognize that really I'm the center of the universe, and the way I see things is always right and accurate, because my happiness is the most important and my suffering hurts more than anybody else's.
Don't you think so?
Huh? So, you know, the reason that anger is exaggerated is because it's totally locked in to that filter of me and assessing and evaluating and interpreting everything through how it affects the center of the universe. Okay? So, for example, if somebody comes in this room, and Pat was up here, so Pat, please excuse me if I use you as an example. Somebody comes up here and looks at Pat and says, "Pat, your introduction was horrible. You know, it was dreadful. I was counting on you to do this great introduction, and you totally blew it." Well, Pat is going to get hurt. She's going to feel angry. Pat's my friend, and they'll look and say, "Pat, don't worry about it, you know, your introduction was fine. That guy has his own agenda. He's blowing off steam. Don't take it personally because he's just projecting the whole thing on you. You know, you don't need to get mad." And I'm certainly not mad if somebody criticizes her. But if after I give a talk, if somebody comes up to me and says, "Children, you really blew it. You know, your talk was awful, and I was counting on you to give them a good talk, and you totally blew it, and nobody could understand it, and you said all these stupid things." Well, we have a little bit different situation here. You know, I'm not going to say what I said to Pat like they're just projecting and blowing off steam and don't take it personally, because they're talking about me, and they're criticizing me and my talk, and we have something bordering on national disaster, you know. And I'm not going to let that go. I'm not going to let that slip away, because I got to stand up and let that guy know that, you know, they're totally out of whack and they better apologize to me. Okay, what's the difference in my reaction? You know, they can say the exact same words to Pat that they say to me. If they look at her and say it, I don't get upset. If they look at me and say the same thing, I get very upset. What's the difference? Only difference is that they're saying it to me, isn't it? Okay? No, it doesn't have to be any difference in the content. Okay? But it becomes so serious when it's directed at me. Why? Because I'm the center of the universe. And everything that happens gets interpreted from that perspective. And that's why it's unrealistic. Because I have to admit, you know, that I'm only one of 5 billion human beings. You know? I'm not really the center of the universe. That everything that happens doesn't happen in relationship to me. When I start to realize that and let go of that self-preoccupation, then a lot of times the way I frame the situation or interpret it changes, and then my anger doesn't come up in the same way. Okay? Another example. How many of you are parents? Yeah. Have you ever noticed that what happens to your child is much more serious than what happens to the neighbor's child? You know? If your neighbor's kid gets a C on the spelling test, no problem. Your kid gets a C on the spelling test? Oh boy, how can my kid get a C on the spelling test? He's not going to get into Harvard. First grade, and he's already a failure. You know, I better do something about this. Okay? Have you ever noticed that? Okay. Why is what happens to your kid more important than what happens to the neighbor's kid? Because the word "my." Okay? So again, you know, whenever we give the word "me," "I," "my," or "mine" to something, it takes on a whole new meaning, and it's a skewed meaning. And we're not usually aware of that skewed meaning that is getting projected because of that word. And instead, we think that what we're experiencing is an objective reality out there. not realizing that we're interpreting everything through the viewpoint of me. Okay? So, what are some ways to work with our anger? First of all, Buddhism is advocating having awareness of our anger, but not just awareness of our anger, but actively being able to let it go or transform it. Okay? So it's not a thing of suppressing or repressing the anger. We're not trying to stuff the anger down and give a nice pretty smile. No problem. You know, that's not what we're trying to do. Because when we do that, we're still angry, aren't we? You know? If you put on this nice smile, you know, I'm being a good Buddhist smile. Do you know that? Yeah. There's a lot of pressure when you're a Buddhist that you have to look nice, you know. You have to look holy. You can't be an angry Buddhist because, you know, then your reputation's going down the hill. So you put on your nice Buddhist smile. Well, you're still, you know, raving inside. That's not working with anger. Well, and well, what's the other alternative? You know, do you yell and scream and, you know, beat pillows and go out in the middle of an empty field and scream? Yeah. Well, you know, some people say that helps with their anger. But on the other hand, if you get in a habit of releasing the physical energy of anger by yelling in a field or beating pillows, what's going to happen when you get angry and there's no pillow to beat but there's just a human being in front of you? Or when there's no field to yell in, there's just a human being in front of you. So if we get in the habit of releasing our anger that way, you know, it's not really reliable and it doesn't really deal with the anger itself. It just relieves the physical component of the anger. So we're not advocating the, you know, expression, dump my anger on top of everybody else thing. And we're not advocating the stuff it inside and pretend you don't have it either, because neither of those work. Okay. What the Buddha was trying to teach us was how to look at a situation in a different way, so that the anger dissipates by itself. Okay? So again, it's not just a thing. You know, people in Buddhism talk a lot about mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is the new buzzword. I'm not so sure people really understand what mindfulness means. And also, mindfulness does mean different things in different Buddhist traditions. So it's not that, you know, here I am raging and I'm mindful that I'm raging, you know. And here I am insulting somebody and I'm mindful that I'm insulting them. And here I am, you know, picking up a flower pot to throw at them and I'm mindful of the sensation of the flower pot in my hand. And I'm mindful of my arm moving back and I'm mindful of it coming forward. Okay. This is not the meaning, the Buddhist meaning of mindfulness. Okay? So we have to be able to recognize our anger. You know, we can't do anything with something that we don't recognize. So we have to be able to recognize the anger, to be aware that we're angry. Okay? But then we have to be mindful of the alternatives to the anger. We have to be mindful of other ways to look at the situation. I mean, it's true that the anger comes up as a lot of energy, and if you wait, it will dissipate by itself. But I think it's very helpful also to learn how to, for us to learn how our anger is an unrealistic emotion. Because if we don't do that, there's always going to be a tendency to think that, you know, to hold on to our anger in some way or another. And we really have to see that it's unrealistic and that it's not beneficial. Okay. So it's unrealistic because I was saying, you know, that just by the definition, we're exaggerating and projecting. Now, what about beneficial? Okay, is anger beneficial? Now, there's a whole group of people in this country that think that anger is very beneficial. I mean, I remember a few years ago, I was I think it was University of Michigan, talking to a group of people, mostly professors, in the conflict resolution, communication, mediation department. And I started talking about the disadvantages of anger, and they got really mad at me. You know, I mean, they were furious. And they were going, what do you mean anger's not beneficial? Anger is very good. When you're angry, you know something's wrong. When you're angry, you have the energy to correct a social injustice. Anger's good. If you aren't angry, you're just going to let everybody step on you, you know, and you're not going to stand up for what's right. So anger's good, they said. Yeah. And they were really quite angry at me. Okay. Now, here we have to look, you know, is anger really beneficial? Is it really necessary in those situations? Okay. So first question is, yeah, is anybody happy when they're angry? Any of you happy when you're angry? No, we're totally miserable. So how is anger beneficial? If right away our immediate experience when we're angry is being miserable, how can anger be a constructive thing? It right away makes us unhappy. Okay. Then, we say and do things under the influence of anger that, do you communicate well when you're under the influence of anger? Do you express yourself well? Do you stop and think about, you know, how to express what you're feeling to the other person so that they'll understand it? We don't think about that when we're angry. You know, we just say it the way it comes out. And, you know, we say it a little loudly in case they have a hearing problem. We repeat it a few times in case they're having a senior moment. You know? I can't remember. But is that communication? Is us saying what we feel communication? I don't think that's necessarily communication. I think communication involves thinking about how to express something so that the other person will understand what we're talking about. We can't do that when we're angry, you know? When we're patient, we can think about what's going wrong in the situation. And we can think about how to communicate it to the other person. But when we're angry, very difficult. Okay. Then, so anger isn't beneficial in terms of increasing good communication. Then, how do you feel about yourself after you've gotten angry? Yeah. Well, there's a few times we say, oh good, I told him off really well, you know. I gave it to him, I hurt his feelings, I gave him a taste of his own medicine. You know that mind? Yeah, I got my revenge. Do we feel good about ourselves when we get our revenge? Is that conducive for our own feeling of self-respect? You know, we might get a little bit of immediate pleasure of, you know, that guy hurt me and now I gave it to him. But in the long term, when we go home and, you know, because we're the one who has to live with ourselves, do we feel good about ourselves when we've hurt other people intentionally? Uh-uh. So, when motivated by anger, we do a lot of things that are harmful of others. Actually, we increase our own feelings of low self-esteem and our own feelings of guilt. So anger isn't beneficial in that way either, is it? Okay. Does anger improve your relationships? what we see on the movies. Have you ever noticed in the movies, you know, because they have to have big fights, otherwise you turn them off. Yeah. So, you know, the characters have to have a big fight every so often. So they yell and scream, and then it seems like they get everything out and they make up. Is life really like that? You yell and scream and tell somebody off, and then they love you more because of it? It's not like that, is it? You know, we say the most incredible things to the people we love the most when we're angry. And we destroy our relationships. Yeah. So it takes a long time to build up trust in a relationship. It doesn't take very long to shatter it. And when we're angry, we should say lots of things that shatter the trust with the people we care about the most. Think about it for a minute. Would you ever speak to a stranger the way you speak to the people you love? Who do you get the angriest at? Strangers or the people you love? Usually people we love, isn't it? People we're close to, we get much angrier at them. Okay. And what I've observed is we get so angry at the people we love that we forget about regular human manners. Because somehow with the people we care about, we feel that there's so much a part of me that I can say whatever I want and this person's always going to be there. You know, they're married to me, or they're my parent, they're my child, they're my sibling. So, you know, I can just let it all out. They're always going to be there. Is that true? Yeah. So I think, you know, actually one remedy for working with anger is don't forget politeness, regular human manners. It's such a small thing, but it makes a huge difference. And especially when we're angry, how we forget about manners and we say things we would never say otherwise that destroy the relationships that are most important to us. If we remember manners, yeah, you know, just the things that our parents taught us when we were kids, like don't throw sand in the play box, yeah, don't call other people names. Just if we remember some of these things, we can start healing a lot of the brokenness in our families. You know, and if we restrain ourselves a little bit when we're angry, you know, always thinking, if this person were a stranger, I wouldn't speak to them this way. You know, and so speaking to the people that we care about with respect, not treating them like they're part of us so we don't need to pay any attention to how we speak or how we act, but treating them with the same respect that we would treat a stranger with. If we did that, we'd get along a lot better with our families. Okay, so just remembering these kinds of disadvantages of anger can help us overcome the anger. Because when we think repeatedly on the disadvantages of something, we develop a much stronger determination not to let it control us. Okay. And we do have a choice when anger's coming up. You know, lots of times it feels like we don't have a choice about what we feel, what our emotions are. You know, somebody criticized me, I don't have any option in what I feel. I have to feel hurt and angry. That's wrong. We always have an option about what we feel. You know, if we catch the anger when it's small, if we remember the disadvantages of getting angry, then, you know, we say to ourselves, hey, I don't want to go down that road, because if I go down that road, it hurts me and it hurts the other person. Okay. So really, sometimes just remembering the disadvantages of something can help us not fall prey to it. Okay, so remembering the disadvantages of anger is one way to help us overcome it. Another way to help us overcome our anger is to look at what our own buttons are, to ask ourselves why we're getting angry. Now this is a very interesting one because you know when the anger's coming and I'll say, okay, why am I getting angry? Well, I'm angry because that person said this and they criticized me and they blame me. Okay, children, it's true, they said that, but why are you angry? Well, because they did this and this and this and this. That's true, they did that, but why are you angry? Okay. I find this way of questioning myself very useful because somebody may have said or done some, you know, hostile thing. But that doesn't mean I have to be angry in response to it. We always say, they made me angry. Does anybody really make us angry? If somebody else makes us angry, then we have no control over our emotions. We have no control over our lives. If somebody makes me angry, then what can I do? I'm a victim. Do other people really make us angry? Or do they do things that we choose to get angry about? Okay, think about it. Because they may do this, that, and the other thing, but why do I have to get angry at it? So when I examine those kinds of things, when I keep asking myself that question, and stop blaming the other person, and keep on asking myself, yes, they may have done that, but why am I angry? Then I have to own that I'm angry. The anger is coming from me. The anger is not coming from them. They aren't making me angry. Anger is not like a virus. It's not like when they're telling me off that there's a virus coming out of their mouth and wham, I got it. You know, I got the angry virus and there I'm angry. No. You know, they're saying and doing whatever they're saying and doing. But it's me that's reacting in anger. So I have to ask myself, why am I reacting in anger? Now when I keep at it and keep asking myself this question, it inevitably comes down to I'm holding on to something. Okay? I'm holding on to an idea of myself. I'm holding on to an idea of the way I think things should be. I'm holding on to a person that I'm attached to. I'm holding on to an object that I want. But somehow or another, when I really investigate why am I angry, it comes down to my mind just holding something. And the thing that I'm holding, or my action of holding, is my button, my sensitive point. And as long as I'm holding that, as long as I'm sensitive about that, I'm going to get angry. Even other people don't intend to make me angry, even they don't intend to hurt my feelings, I'm going to get angry because I'm so sensitive about that. Okay? I'll give you an example. I have a friend who had a baby a few years back. When you have a baby, you put on weight, right? Yeah, you're supposed to put on weight when you have a baby. If you don't put on weight, something's wrong. Okay? So my friend, of course, she put on weight. She had the baby. She was nursing the baby. She weighed more than she did before. Everything was totally normal. She was taking the baby back home for the holidays to where her family lived in another state. And so before she left for the trip, you know, we were talking and she said, I know when I get off the airplane, my sister's going to meet me at the airport, and first thing she's going to do is look at me and go, you've put on weight. And that's going to drive me nuts. my friend was saying. I mean, she was already angry at her sister. Okay, she hadn't even gotten on the plane. Her sister wasn't at the airport. Her sister hadn't even said that. But she already had it scripted out and was already angry. Okay? So she's holding on to something there, isn't she? You know? She's holding on to this image of I'm only worthwhile when I'm thin, which is a totally false image that I think American advertising has falsely sold women and men, and I think we need to throw that image out. But if we hold on to that I'm only worthwhile when I look a certain way, then we're going to get angry whenever somebody says anything to us about the way we look. And probably because my friend was so sensitive about the way she looked, that my guess is if her sister looked at her and said, wow, you look really great, my friend's going to think, who are you trying to pull it off? You know, you're just making fun of me because you're really thinking I'm fat. You know? And because when we're angry, we find something to get angry about. Even if somebody, you know, doesn't mean to push our button, they don't mean to insult us, if we have a button, if we're holding on to something, we're going to get angry. Okay? So it's very helpful for us to do some research and ask ourselves, you know, what is my button? What am I holding on to? Lots of times what I find is I'm holding on to an image of who I am and an idea of how people should treat me. You know? Because after all, remember, I'm the center of the universe. You know? And I'm this and I'm this and I'm this and I'm this. And the whole world should know it. And the world should treat me respectfully. They should honor me. Yeah, they shouldn't say anything mean about me because I'm so good intentioned, I'm so kind. Yeah. I mean, I'm a Buddhist after all. Right? But even if not, you know, I'm me. I'm a nice person. People should treat me respectfully. They should offer to do me favors. They should notice the things I do well because I do so many things well. Yeah. They shouldn't notice my faults because my faults are just accidents. You know? And if they notice my faults, they're just making a mountain out of a molehill. And so, I mean, does anybody else here find that they have kind of a set of rules about how the world should treat me? Yeah? Do you have that? And have you ever noticed that somehow the world doesn't get it? You know, that the world doesn't, they don't get who we are and how they should treat us. And so we get upset about this, and then of course we have to correct them, teach them what's right. That works real well, doesn't it? Okay. So, you know, it's real helpful to start noticing these buttons, all these preconceptions in our own mind. Because the more we can let them go, then the less there's going to be to get angry about. Because we're not going to be holding on to false ideas to start with. Now, what about this whole idea of we need to get angry in order to correct social injustice? Yeah? Anybody think that? Yeah? It seems right, doesn't it? You know, because if we're not angry, we're going to let racism and abuse and, you know, Al-Qaeda and everybody, you know, keep running us over. So we've got to stand up for our principles and for what's right. And anger is the way to stand up for it. I think that way of thinking is based on the assumption that anger is the only motivating force we can have to stand up to injustice and abuse. Is that correct? That anger is the only thing that can motivate us to change harmful things or to intercede? I don't think so. Okay? What about the force of compassion? Because remember, compassion doesn't mean being withy. Compassion isn't just, oh, it's okay, dear, you know. Because we get this idea of compassion, like, you know, some drunken guy comes home and beats his wife, and the next morning she says, it's okay, dear, you know, I know you beat me last night and the night before, but I love you and I'm so compassionate for you and I forgive you. And, you know. Is that compassion? That's stupidity. Excuse me, that's not compassion. So don't confuse compassion and stupidity. Don't confuse compassion and passivity. The thing about compassion, and compassion, the Buddhist definition, is the wish for self and others to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Okay? The thing about compassion is when we wish self and others to be free of suffering and its causes, then in an abusive or a harmful situation, we're going to have compassion for both the perpetrator and for the victim. If we can have compassion for everybody in the situation, our mind is going to be calmer and we're going to be much more likely to come up with a solution that is going to solve the problem. If we only have compassion for the victim and we hate the perpetrator, then we're going to want to inflict harm on the perpetrator. When we inflict harm, when we punish, when we beat somebody else up, are they going to be nicer and stop their bad behavior? No. They're going to get angrier and keep on doing what they're doing. Okay? So actually, compassion, I think, is a much stronger motivating force and a much more effective motivating force for correcting social injustices, for interceding when there's harmful situations. Okay? Let's look at a political example. Okay? 1948, 1949, 1950, a very similar event happened to two different peoples. Okay? 1948, the Palestinians lost a section of their territory and many of them became refugees. 1949, 1950, Communist China occupied Tibet. The Tibetans lost their independence. Okay? And became refugees. Happened right around the same time. Okay? Now, if you look at the Palestinian way of, you know, working for their cause. And I'm not commenting here on the validity of the cause, okay, because I think people have the right for self-determination. But I'm talking about the methods being used to achieve that. Okay. If we look at the history of the Palestinian cause, you know, remember years ago there were hijacking planes, there was murder at the Olympics, now there's suicide bombs. There's been a steady history of violence. Okay? They still don't have their independence and their freedom, do they? You look at the Tibetans, lost their freedom, mass imprisonment, so many became refugees. The Tibetans, by and large, did not resort to violence. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has consistently emphasized, do not be angry at the communist Chinese for what they did to our country. Okay? Has the Dalai Lama just turned the other cheek and done nothing? No. He's active, you know, and is, you know, encouraging people to get the word out about the Tibetan situation. Okay? So he's using nonviolent means to fight. Nonviolent means to fight for the freedom of his country. The Tibetans still also don't have their freedom. But when you compare the number of people who have died in the Palestinian cause and the number of people who have died fighting for Tibetan freedom, big difference. Big difference. Okay? And if you look who has more international respect, Arafat or the Dalai Lama, think about it. Okay? So you can see that compassion, you know, and nonviolence can be a very, very effective way of fighting injustice. And it doesn't have to be ineffective. And violence is not necessarily effective. Okay? We often have the feeling that if we punish the people who hurt us, that then they're going to stop hurting us. So we have this feeling that if we let our anger come up and put our anger out there, you know, they're going to stop hurting us because they're going to be afraid of us. So we have the philosophy of, I'm going to beat you up so badly until you decide to be nice to me. Isn't that what we do? You know, we do it in personal relationships. We yell and scream and say awful, cruel things to people. And somehow we're thinking that after we do this, they're going to be nice to us. Does it work? No. This is also our foreign policy, isn't it? Okay, I'm going to beat you up. I'm going to drop bombs on you. I'm going to make you suffer until you decide to be nice. Does it work as foreign policy? No. Okay. It's almost in our foreign policy, I'm speaking about this on September 12th, 1 year later. But I don't know how many of you felt this way, but I was feeling that a year ago, and even now, that we were getting the message that it is patriotic to be angry. I see some nodding heads. And if you're not angry, then somehow you don't love your country. If you're not angry, if you don't want to retaliate, if you don't want to inflict harm and drop bombs and kill and murder people, then somehow you're lacking compassion for the innocent people who died in the bombings. Is that true? That just because you don't want to retaliate, you lack compassion? That's not true. Okay? And so if we look, even as a nation, having this feeling, you know, I'm going to beat you up and vent my anger until you decide to be nice, it's not going to work as a foreign policy. In fact, if anything, it's going to trigger more and more attacks against us. And see, this is the value of compassion, because when you have compassion, you not only see your own viewpoint in a conflict, but you make an effort to listen to the viewpoint of the other person. And not just listen with the ears, but listen with the heart. And really trying to understand why is this person upset? How are they perceiving the situation? What are their needs and concerns? And as long as a country, you know, if our president's saying, I don't know why they're angry at us, I don't know why they hate us and our way of life. Huh? Excuse me? You know? How are we going to remedy conflict if we can't understand what the needs and concerns are of the other people? We may not agree with them, but we have to understand them. Okay? So this works on an international level. It works on the level when there's conflict between groups. It works on a personal level. We have to broaden our compassion to not only our side, but the other side. To not only the victim's side, but the perpetrator's side. So that means we need to open our heart, and we need to see everybody as equally wanting happiness, and everybody as equally wanting to be free of suffering. Okay. That's a little bit about anger, yeah. I want to open it up maybe to some questions and responses here. There's a lot more I can say, but I think it's nice if we can have a little bit of dialogue at this point.
So we'll take questions. We'll bring the mic down. I would like to ask the first question, though. Thank you so much. for speaking to us about anger. I've noticed in my life that oftentimes I hold a kind of anger that is tied up with unforgiving, an unforgiving nature. And I don't have a good handle on it. I feel like if I forgive somebody for something that they've done to me, which clearly has made me angry and hurt, I have condoned what they've done and not, I keep holding on to the fact that I should be hurt by what they did to me, thus I can't forgive them. I'd really like you to speak to
okay.
that.
Okay, so about forgiveness and overcoming resentment, overcoming grudges, okay? Because grudges, a grudge is when we hold on to our anger for a long time, and we don't want to forgive, very often because we feel that forgiving means condoning what the other person did. I don't think that, okay? My definition of forgiving means that we're going to stop being angry about what somebody did. It doesn't mean that we're saying what they did is okay. Okay. Because what people do sometimes is not okay. It is inappropriate, it's damaging, it's hurtful. Okay. It's terrifying. But we can still forgive them without condoning what they've done. Because forgiveness is simply saying, I'm going to let go of my anger because when I hold a grudge, I'm the one who's hurting. Have you ever noticed that? When you hold a grudge, who's hurting? Is the other person hurting? No, sometimes they're already dead. You know, sometimes they're lying on the beach enjoying, they're drinking tea, they're having a good time. We're sitting there going, you know? And have you ever noticed with grudge holding, when you do a meditation practice, you see this very clearly, you know, you sit there and you're meditating, like let's say you're doing breathing meditation, so you're absorbed, you know, you're watching your breath, so you get two breaths, and then, my friend was really mean to me last Tuesday. How could they see this? I never really noticed that. You know, they're treating me like this a lot. You know, it wasn't just last Tuesday. This has been going on for a long time. How could I not have noticed this relationship is rotten? I can't stand that person. It's so hurtful and painful what they say. And you can do a whole meditation on this. Can't you? You know, no distraction. Who says we don't have samadhi? Then all of a sudden, you know, you hear ding. You know, you open your eyes, you know. Oh, that my friend who was making me angry isn't even here in the room. I was just in a rage. The person who's making me angry isn't here. Who's creating the anger? Where's the anger coming from? Well, it's the same thing when we hold a grudge, when we hold on to resentment. The other person did something to us once or twice, but every time we remember it and we go through it again, yeah, we do it to ourselves again and again and again. They did it once, we do it to ourselves many, many times. We make ourselves angry, we build up a grudge, we have a whole court case. Have you ever noticed that you have a court case? Yeah, I have a court case. You know, there's a judge and the jury and the prosecutor all in here. Okay. And I have all these reasons about how what the other person did was wrong and it's bad and it's negative and they owe me an apology and how could they possibly do this? And, you know, the prosecutor's really going at it. You know, and the judge is on my side, the jury's on my side. I am right, hands down. You know, when I call my friends agree with me. And because after all, they wouldn't be my friends if they didn't agree with me. Yeah. So, you know, how can I possibly forgive this other person when, you know, I'm right and the whole world's on my side. I had a situation a couple of years ago when somebody did something really nasty to me. I could tell you the whole story because I have the mic, but I'll spare you. but if you really want to know. Anyway, because sometimes people think that nobody's mean to a nun. Let me tell you. So somebody had been really mean to me, you know, and my friends agreed, you know, and all of our common friends agreed that he was wrong and what he did was wrong, and, you know, and I knew what he did was wrong, and I was right and he was wrong, and I was totally miserable. And I was telling a friend of mine about this, and she looked at me and she said, "Children, you can be right all you want to, but you're not going to be happy." And I went, "You're right." You know? Because as long as I hold on to my resentment, I am torturing myself. Okay? So resentment, grudge holding, is the perfect form of self-torture. We don't need anybody else to make us miserable. We do it by ourselves. Yeah. So forgiving somebody is simply a process of letting go of that anger in our own heart and letting ourselves relax and be happy. And it doesn't involve condoning what the other person did. We can still say that what they did was wrong or inappropriate or hurtful, but we're just going to stop being angry about it. Now, again, when I look inside, what prevents me from doing that? One thing is, I want the other person to acknowledge that they hurt me. I want something from them. You know, I'm hurt, I feel crummy, I've been crying for days and weeks and months, and they have to admit how mean they were to me. And I'm not going to let go of this until they admit it. Right? So when I look, and I look at that mind state that's doing that, and I realize that when I think like that, I've given away my power. I've made myself into a victim because I'm saying I can't be happy unless they do something. And how in the world am I going to make them do something? I can't make them do anything. You know? So I have to, when I was talking about our buttons and the things that we hold on to, I have to let go of my wish for public acknowledgement for the amount of hurt that I've undergone. I have to let go of that. And if I ask myself, well, what good will it do me, even if this person publicly, or even privately, you know, I'll let them off the hook. They just need to say it to me, not the newspaper. You know, how much they've harmed me. What good does it do me for them to, for them to acknowledge that what they did was hurtful? What good does it really do me if I ask myself that? You know, they're acknowledging what they did. They're apologizing to me. It doesn't really do anything for me. You know? Why should my happiness be contingent upon them? So I think the thing is here, really feeling, you know, I'm not giving away my power. I'm not making myself into a victim. Okay? And it's because I care about myself and I respect myself that I'm giving up my anger and I'm forgiving them. Okay? Forgiving doesn't mean you forget. Okay? Because some things need to be remembered. We need to remember the Holocaust. Okay? If somebody mistreats us, it's good to remember that to make sure we don't get into a similar situation with them again. But we don't have to bear a grudge in order to do that. Okay? Make some sense? Yes. Anila. I find myself wanting to make a comment, and that leads to a question. Mm-hmm. And you'll have to forgive me, because I'm going to be a student of yours in the moment to see how well can I practice what you've just spoken. Mm-hmm. I'm a third generation refugee Palestinian. My grandparents lost their homes in 1948. My parents lost their homes in 1948 as well. And I can't help but have some reaction to the example that you offered this evening, which I find, again, an opportunity to practice. I have grown up with a lot of anger about the Palestinian situation. I've also spent most of my life studying conflict resolution, and I am a practicing Tibetan Buddhist so that I can find peace and resolution within myself and hopefully one day influence that part of the world by some small action. Mm-hmm. So, my question is this. How would the Buddha influence, in my perception, a Sharon who hates Arafat and an Arafat who is very angry at Israel? You have two people who are probably expressing anger in very different forms currently. And I can make arguments about Arafat's choices, and I'm not sitting here advocating Arafat, but I think often in this country it has been very easily labeled that the Palestinians don't deserve a state because look at all the harm they have caused to many people. And it's an easy conclusion when you see what Arafat has, the tools that he's chosen for Palestinians, wrong or good, it's not up to me to judge. Has managed to allow the Palestinians to hold on to the thread of hope that they have for some kind of resolution. I'm not agreeing with his particular tactics, but a very small squeaky wheel has managed to stay, in the forefront of realpolitik. So I'm not agreeing with the way that it's done. I have opinions about that. However, it was done. Mm-hmm. And yet, here we are, 2002. Things have not changed that much. There's still a lot of anger. I'm not saying there are plenty of Israelis and plenty of Palestinians who are very amicable with one another, and have done a lot of work in that region. But how would the Buddha influence these two people who hold the lives of Israelis and Palestinians? Yeah? If you can comment, that would be very good.
Thank you. First thing I think the Buddha would do is put him in a meditation retreat in silence. It's interesting, you were saying Sharon and Arafat were different. I see them as mirror reflections of each other. I see what the Palestinians and the Israelis are doing as basically the same thing. Because it's both of their actions are coming from the same state of mind, saying, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm going to torture you and make you miserable until you decide to be nice to me. And Sharon is thinking that, and Arafat's thinking that. And actually, if they only had the same cause, they'd get along very well. If you think about it, really, because their whole attitude is very, very similar. Yeah. The Tibetans also have a hope. Yeah, the violence hasn't been necessary to keep the thread of hope alive. Yeah, hope can exist without the violence. The anger is there, and the anger is real, and you can't tell people don't be angry, okay? But I think what is needed, especially in the Middle Eastern situation, is for, they need a cooling off period, but they also need to learn to listen to each other, and they need to learn to understand each other's history. I've been to Israel and also the West Bank and Gaza several times, and I've heard people on both sides. And I grew up Jewish, so I understand the Israeli mindset to some extent. And what I think has happened is, how psychologists have shown that people who were abused as children very often become abusers as adults? I think this is what you've seen in that situation. That the Jews felt so terrorized and trampled on after the Holocaust that they said never again, and they are carrying out what the Nazis did to them in an attempt to stay alive themselves, not realizing that they've become the abusers. And I think the Palestinians are doing a very similar thing, you know. And if you look, both sides, it's all coming from pain, okay? I don't think the real thing is that people hate each other so much. I think the real thing is that people hurt, and they don't know what to do with their hurt. Yeah? And I think that's the reason for a lot of our anger in this country after 9/11, is because we were hurt and we were afraid. And it's very uncomfortable to feel hurt and afraid. When we feel angry and when we act out of violence, we don't feel powerless anymore. And we don't have to look at our hurt and our fear when we're angry, because anger gives us this zoom of energy that masks the uncomfortable feelings of hurt and fear. Yeah? So I think, you know, if I were the Buddha, I should only be so lucky. I should only work so hard. You know, that what is what's necessary is really deep listening to what the other person has experienced, and deep compassion for the plight of the other one, seeing how much the other is similar to oneself. Yeah? Because as soon as we see how somebody else is similar to ourselves, it becomes possible for the situation to move. I was talking to a friend of mine who was also a Buddhist, who worked in the police force when there were hostage situations. And I said, how do you defuse a hostage situation? And he said, you try and help the person, the hostage taker, to see something that they have in common with the hostage. Yeah. He said the situations that are most difficult to resolve are when the hostage taker and the hostages don't have contact, when they put something over the face of the hostages so the hostage takers don't have to look at them. He said the first thing you do is try and help the person who's the hostage taker to see something they have in common with the other person. And then you have a foot in the door, you know, because I think people, at the root of it, you know, people are compassionate. And if they can let that compassion out, if they can really get in touch in that moment with how we both want to be happy, we both want to be free of suffering, then there's a potential to act out of that. Okay?
I'd like for you to speak to, you have a room full of probably peaceful Buddhist-inspired people. I would like for you to speak toward a relationship that you are with, or living with, an angry person, and that angry person, and how to best, what one should do. And we are now living with President Bush and Vice President Cheney and it doesn't look like that anger and that attitude is going to change before we really dire things are about to happen. Now, we can appreciate that, we can recognize that, we can understand the conflict, we can understand how we got to this place, but it's like sitting on top of a hill and watching two trains coming up down the same track toward each other.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your, how do we best do that if we do? We've done our homework, we've recognized that we are peaceful, we are not arguing and we're not hating them,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, let's not lose sight of the fact that the Dalai Lama did leave Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
yeah. Okay, so when you're caught up in a conflict that's not of your own making and you feel powerless to prevent it, Okay, there's a couple of things here. One is I feel that we need to speak out. It's very interesting because I think there's a real hesitancy on the part of the people who don't want war in this country. There's hesitancy to speak out because there is so much pressure that you've got to be angry to be patriotic. And I have spoken all over the country since 9/11, and I tell you there are a lot of people who do not want war and who are not angry about this. So it's, I mean, okay, I speak to certain types of people, but I've spoken to a lot of these types of people all over the country, okay? And so it's not just this small, insignificant number. So I think, first of all, people need to speak out and people need to do something, okay? Even though we may not feel that our voice is appreciated, we need to say it anyway. Second thing, in terms of being caught up in a conflict that isn't our own making, I mean, I had this feeling very strongly after 9/11, like, hey, wait a minute, and even now, you know, with the war talk in this country, I'm like, hey, I don't want to be involved in this. You know, if this is, you know, Bush's quarrel with Saddam, let them both go in the kindergarten sandbox and throw sand at each other, but don't get the rest of us involved, because we don't want to be involved in your conflict. But here we are, and we don't have a choice. And then, you know, we can either fall into despair, or what I've done is I look and I say, why am I in this situation? My karma got me here. Okay? I created the causes to be in this situation. I don't like this situation. I don't know what's going to happen to me in this situation. I don't know what's going to happen to our planet in this situation. But I'm here because I created the cause through my past actions. So I can't just be angry at everybody else, and I can't just feel like a victim in it. I have to say, you know, through my own self-centered actions, I got myself born at this time in this society, in this situation. So I have to live with it, and I have to find a way to be ethical, to be peaceful, to be forgiving, and to be optimistic in this situation. And this is my practice. Okay?
Hi, thank you for being here. I have a question for people who are not able to be here tonight. So what I notice in myself is that it takes time to process anger from its rising to its ultimate dissipation. And I personally have found it useful to step back from the situation to do my best to dissipate it before re-entering the situation. I'm interested in the practical applications that are combined with fear, however, on bigger problems. And I'd like your inspiring words to new or hesitant practitioners who have experienced anger with fear when the stimuli come in rapid succession. For example, losing a job, losing your car, losing your house, losing your husband, losing your children, simply because the finances don't really afford the same resources and opportunities that you might have previously experienced.
Okay, so you're kind of asking when you have a lot of stresses at one time, when a lot of things in your life fall apart at one time, when a lot of change that you didn't volunteer for is being demanded of you.
Yeah, and I think I'm also asking because I think it's much more complex when you have when these changes happening to you have rippling impacts on when they have rippling negative impacts on your loved ones, like people you're supporting or children.
Yeah, right.
So any inspiring words would be great.
Yeah. Okay. So when things kind of fall apart and they're affecting not only us but the people we care about. Okay, I had a situation like this recently, actually. And, you know, the temptation is to get angry and to think the universe isn't treating me right, you know, and to blame the social structures in the country, to blame, you know, stupid decisions on the part of bureaucrats or politicians, to blame anybody, it doesn't matter. What I find helpful for me, again, is this thing of recognizing my energy, my past actions got me in this situation. Okay? So this requires some kind of understanding of cause and effect, and particularly karma, our actions and their effects. Okay? So, for me this is helpful, because when I blame somebody else, I get more miserable because I'm angry and I feel powerless. If I say that earlier this life or even in a previous life I did something harmful to others, therefore I find myself in this situation now, it becomes much easier for me to accept the situation. This does not mean I deserve to suffer. Okay? Repeat. Okay? Because people often misunderstand this. This does not mean that somebody experiencing suffering deserves to suffer. It simply means that when we've created the cause, we experience the result. And if, as an adult, you know, I look at the situation, I don't like the results I'm experiencing, then I have to start creating different causes and stop creating the kind of causes I've been creating. Okay, so I find seeing the situation through this viewpoint of karma and its effects helps me see a way in which I can change and have more control of my situation. It also gives me the perspective that this thing of everything falling apart is temporary. Okay, it's not going to last forever. Things happen because causes exist. Causal energy does not exist forever. It ceases. It changes into something else. So, okay, I'm having a hard time now, but the situation is changing moment by moment. It's not going to last forever. When I was having these problems that I just referred to, I was talking to another friend of mine who's a Buddhist, a very dear friend. And he said to me, "Chitran, this is samsara, what do you expect?" And I realized I was expecting happiness. You know, I expect to be in samsara with a mind overwhelmed by ignorance, anger, and attachment, and still be happy. Yeah? I expect to have a body that is in the nature of suffering and never get sick. I expect to have a body that is in the nature of impermanence and never die. Okay? When I come back to my Buddhist training and realize, you know, when the Buddha talked about the disadvantages of cyclic existence, the faults of samsara, what I'm experiencing now is exactly what he's talking about. And when he's talking about renunciation, he's not just talking about renouncing my painful experiences now, but renouncing the mental attitudes, the negative emotions, and my destructive actions that got me in this experience. He's talking about renouncing the ignorance that keeps me bound in this cycle. So if I don't like these kinds of experiences, I have to come back to my practice and use the tools I have to purify my karma, to remedy my ignorance, to contribute something positive to this planet. Yeah? Okay?
I am an activist in a community of color. And I have been struggling for several years to change the police state under which we live. And I work very hard trying to talk to the police permission, to police people. I've even attended a citizens academy, police academy, trying to get a perspective of compassion for them. And what I learned was there's a joy and power among young people who choose that profession. And what I saw at the police academy is the emphasis is on use of force. And after all these years of work, my frustration just seems to grow in terms of finding a way to make a change in people's thinking. So I'm still at the place where I can be gardening peacefully and a siren will zoom by and I start my expletives about the cops. So I give myself a lecture and vow not to let that happen again, but it does. And a lot, because there's a lot of sirens in my neighborhood. So when you say that stopping the feelings before they start, it's like, I'm mystified, I don't get it.
Okay, I heard a few different questions in what you said. One was a question about wanting to make a change and feeling like you're not able to make the change to the degree that you would like to be able to make it in. I think many of us feel that way. And we have an American fix-it mind. Okay? Whether we are activists and liberals, or whether you're conservative and on police, we want to fix it. Our American fix-it mind wants to fix problems ASAP as easily as possible. We are a fix-it country. Our foreign policy is based on fixitism. Okay? So it's very easy for us to get discouraged when we work hard. And again, the world doesn't get it. And, you know, we expect it to be able to fix the problem, change the problem, and it isn't changing according to the schedule we would like to see it happen at. I think that rather than fall into despair, it's because if we fall into despair because we're attached to getting our goals achieved, we're not just satisfied with the process, but we're attached to the goals. And we don't have any control over what other people think and say and do. So I think what we have to adopt instead of is an attitude that is happy to create the causes. And I will create the causes for peace as much as I can in myself, in my family, in my social group, in my community, in my country. But I recognize that I don't have control over what other people do. And I'm going to be satisfied contributing to peace. I'm going to be satisfied creating the causes. And I'm not going to be focused on the result of my agenda and fall into despair. Okay? Because despair doesn't do anybody any good. Okay? So to contribute what we can, without feeling like we should be powerful enough to change the whole situation. Because we aren't powerful enough to change the whole situation. Okay? Just as one person isn't powerful enough to make the whole situation happen. So we do our share, and we do what we can, and we spread goodwill where we're capable of. Okay? In terms of, you know, you said when the emotions arise to catch them. I think maybe some very consistent daily meditation practice on equanimity for who you see as the police or the soldiers or the people that you're opposed to. Think about their lives. Think about how they grew up. And this is one thing that, you know, remember the whole Rodney King incident? What was going on and how many things happened then? And there were so many emotions in the country at that time. And I remember thinking that if I had grown up like Rodney King, I would have probably felt and thought and done what he did. If I had grown up like the cops who beat him, I would have felt and thought and done what the cops did. If I had grown up like the Korean grocers, I would have done what they did. If I had grown up as the truck drivers, I would have done what they did. Why? Because I have the seeds of all of that within myself. I'm not free of anger and resentment and prejudice and hate. I like to pretend I am. But if I look deeply, the seeds of those things exist in me. I have to own that. So how can I hate and judge somebody else who suffers from the same disease as I do? Especially when they were in a situation where that disease got cultivated. I have to have compassion for them. Because I have to have some compassion for the side of me that's like them. Okay. I do prison work. It's very easy when you do prison work to make a lot of things black and white. But I try when I go into the prisons to see the pain not only of the prisoners, but the pain of the guards. I don't think prison is a fun place to work in. You know? Sure, the people may have a sense of power and get off on that sense of power, but I don't think they're really having a good time at work. Yeah. There's a lot of suffering involved being in a guard in a prison. They aren't very well paid. They aren't well respected. They have their own fear. If I can tune into what they're doing and feel some empathy for that, there's a chance of maybe communicating with them.
Okay. If you take one more question, this will be our last question, and thank you again.
Thank you. my question kind of returns to the issue of forgiveness for harm done. Sometimes there are situations of really, really like grave hurt, like for example, like incest or sexual abuse of a child, mm-hmm. and sometimes the victim is as a coping mechanism will just. So that if they can survive, they'll just numb out any kind of feeling, right? They won't feel anger, and then subsequently that person is unable to be angry at all. Like they just don't feel the arising of mm-hmm. anger. And so I guess what I'm wondering about, and I know I heard you say that it's not, anger is not practical, and I could see the logic of that. But I guess what I'm wondering about is, would that person need to have the experience of feeling anger towards mm-hmm. the abuser before they can forgive that person if they've numbed it out completely through their whole mm-hmm. life?
Okay. I think it depends a lot on the individual. If a person has suppressed anger, now, well then to deal with your anger, you have to be able to experience it before you can deal with it. So if there's anger that's being repressed or suppressed, it needs to surface, you know, before the person can actively deal with it. Now, whether everybody who numbs out actually has anger, repressed anger, I don't know. You know, that's up for every person to discover within themselves. Okay? I've seen some people who go to therapy and their therapist is telling them that they need to feel angry and they should feel angry. And I've seen people try very hard to feel angry because their therapist wants them to. I don't think that that's necessarily, you know, good for that person. Because a person feels what they feel. You know, how can somebody say you should be mad because you were abused? Maybe you don't feel mad. Or maybe you do feel mad, but if you try and feel mad, you're not going to feel mad. You know? So I think we need to give people space to go through their processes in their own time, in their own way. And it's not for me to say what somebody else who is numbed out really feels, because I don't know. I can help them talk about what they are feeling, and maybe in the process they'll feel other things. But I don't want to approach the situation with an agenda of how I think they should feel or what I think they do feel that they don't recognize. Okay?
Before we break, perhaps you could mention Srivasti Adi and your work there.
Oh, okay.
And then we'll end. Thank you very much for being here.
So Srivasti Adi, the name Srivasti was chosen by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We had submitted several names for him to choose from. Srivasti is the place in ancient India where the Buddha spent 25 rainy season retreats. So you'll see at the beginning of a lot of sutras, you know, when the Blessed One was dwelling in Srivasti, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he spoke this sutra at that place. When I visited Srivasti years ago, I noticed that there was a nun's community and a monk's community there. And so this is very much an inspiration for me in setting up an abbey in America, is to have monks and nuns and gender equality. So this is something new in Buddhism, okay? But I feel quite strongly, you know, equal access to teachings, to ordination, to practice, to retreats, to everything. To have the abbey be completely gender equal. Or better yet, gender irrelevant. Okay? The reason, you know, people say, well, why do you need an abbey in America? Well, because there isn't one. You know, there's a lot of Tibetan Buddhists in America, aren't they? There's a lot of Dharma centers in America. There is not one monastery in the Tibetan tradition in this country where new people can go and train how to be monastics. There's a couple of households of a few monks and nuns living together here and there. But there's not a place where people can go before they ordain and live the ordained lifestyle and really experience it and see if that's what they want. There's not a place where they can go to get training. Western monastics, when they ordain, are set out in the middle of nowhere. If you ordain and you're Tibetan, you go in a monastery. You have financial support. Your society supports you. If you're a Westerner and you ordain, you have zero financial support. And very often people are expected to go out and get a job to support themselves. Now how, as a new monk and nun, are you going to learn the essence of monastic life if you have to put on lay clothes, grow your hair out, and work at a regular, ordinary job, and live a regular, ordinary life? Forget it! You know, and this is why so many people have, you know, wind up giving back their ordination, because they don't have the conducive situation to live in where they have an environment where they have room and board, and they can, and they have teachers, and they have the time to study. So I see a monastery as something that's not only, you know, good for the monastics, for their training, but when you have a solid group of monastics in this country, you have the flourishing of the Dharma in this country. Why? Because monastics have more time to practice and to study, because they don't have families. And they don't have social engagements. Yeah. And when you have people who have done a lot of, you know, serious practice and study, then they can go out and they can help. They can teach the Dharma, they can do hospice work, prison work. There's so much work that I think is open for really dedicated people to do in this country. So we need monasteries as training places for these people. And I also have the idea of a monastery where people who aren't ordained can come when they're burnt out in the city, you know, and you want to go live in a place where people keep good ethical discipline, where the center of their life is the Dharma, and where you can participate in sharing a community life with them for a week or a few days or a month, however long you like. So I see it as, you know, establishing an abbey as something that benefits the monastics, the broader society, and the community of Buddhists in general. So because there isn't one, we need one. We need more than one, actually. But before you can have more, you have to start with one. So, you know, this is kind of what I have a lot of energy to do. Okay? So right now we're at the place, I'm living in Missouri temporarily at a Chinese temple, but that is not, you know, our land to start the abbey. So I am in the process of looking for land, you know, we're looking either for donations of land or for donations of money to be able to buy land. One of my students is looking in Idaho at the moment for land. So we're still looking for the location. We're at the beginning of it. Okay? Good. Okay, so she's saying people can make donations at the information table. And there's also brochures. You can take brochures on with you. There's a website that you can look on and so on and so forth. Before we close, let's just sit quietly for a moment. Okay, so let's just, you know, 1 or 2 minutes of sitting quietly. But think about something that was significant for you in what we talked about tonight. So be aware of something that you want to take home with you and practice as a result of what we shared together this evening. And then let's dedicate the positive energy that we accumulated this evening as individuals and as a group. And let's dedicate this goodness, this positive energy, sending it out throughout our world, throughout the entire universe. And dedicate the fruits of our efforts so that everybody can live peacefully within themselves and together with others. Let's dedicate so that everybody can meet a spiritual path that makes sense to them, that helps them develop ethical conduct, compassion, and wisdom. Let's dedicate so that everybody can progress along the path to enlightenment. and have not only temporal happiness, but the long-lasting ultimate happiness that comes through internal spiritual transformation. So let's wish that for each and every living being, no matter whether they agree with us or not, whether they like us or not, whether they help or harm us. Let's dedicate the fruits of our efforts for their happiness and well-being. Thank you all very much.